Sal Campo. I'm the Scholarly Communication Librarian at OHSU. Before joining OHSU, which is maybe an interesting or unusual path to my current job, I was actually on the vendor side. So I have worked for Blackwell, a large company that's no longer in existence on the library vendor side, that essentially sold monographs and other kinds of services to academic libraries. And then before that, I was vice president of business development at eBook Library. So I think I have a bit of an unusual perspective being brought to my current position. So the title of my talk is Car Science, Intellectual Property, and Scientific Communication. I told you my background a little bit, but another brief disclaimer, and that is I am a librarian. I believe that rewards are good. Individuals and organizations should be rewarded for their creativity, products, and work, but that ultimately those incentives should drive scientific discovery and innovation and understanding. And you could argue that the U.S. Constitution agrees with me. So if you look at the foundation of modern intellectual property law in our Constitution, it states that Congress has the power to promote progress by rewarding individuals with limited, exclusive rights to their creations and inventions. When we're talking about journal publishing and scientific publishing in journals, what we're really talking about in terms of intellectual property is copyright. And a few things that you should know about copyright to begin with is, one is that it's not the ideas that are copywritten, it is the expression of those ideas. So if you think about that in terms of science, it is not the science, it is not the discovery that copyright is wrapped around, it's the expression of the science. Copyright grants a set of rights to the creator of a work. Those rights include to sell and produce and reproduce a work. It includes the right to create derivatives of that work. It includes the right, and this will be important, to transfer the rights of that work and to publicly display that work. A couple other things is that within copyright law, it's really on the onus of the copyright holder to enforce copyright. And then finally, there are limitations. There are limitations in terms of the length of copyright, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment. But there are also a lot of limitations in terms of what others can do with that work without having to ask permission. And that's kind of codified in fair use. And fair use isn't very specific, but it allows certain kinds of use, educational, commentary use, and those that, if it falls under fair use, you evaluate it through four things. What is the nature of the use? Is it educational, for example? What is the nature of a work? Was it previously unpublished versus something that was published? How much of the work was used? And then what was the impact of the work? So for example, does the specific kind of use that you have in mind, will it impact the copyright holders or rights holders' ability to make money off of that work? So when libraries, when individuals are thinking about fair use, they're assessing it against those kind of four parameters. But increasingly, we've seen a movement within copyright and intellectual property more generally, away from the concept of this limited reward and exclusive, exclusivity more towards ownership and sort of creating more of affinity between kind of tangible property ownership and the concept of intellectual property. And I would argue that that's a significant departure from the spirit of the founding fathers' sort of original idea of copyright as codified within the Constitution. And you can see that this with specific examples. You can see with case law, but if you just look at the length of copyright as it's developed over time, original copyright law specifically allowed for a maximum rights term of 28 years. 14 years and then the possibility to extend it for another 14. Currently, copyright, the length of copyright is for when the work is produced, the life of the creator plus another 70 years. So that's a significant sort of evolution towards that side of ownership rather than that incentive system. So let's, if you take a look at this kind of workflow and copyright within the life cycle of the publication life cycle. So you have your scientist. Your scientist creates a manuscript, and at that point, copyright is automatically granted. That no longer does a creator have to file for copyright protection. Copyright is automatically granted, so they have those groups of rights that scientists have, that group of rights that I described. But then, in a traditional publication workflow, the author then transfers most, if not all, of her rights to a publisher, and specifically those rights that are connected to the dissemination and ability to be rewarded monetarily for that work. The publisher distributes that work and reserves its rights, its copyrights that were transferred to it by the author. And then it's read, and at that point, you know, the publisher has the ability and often the means to enforce its right as the copyright holder. But anyone who deals with this knows it's a lot more complicated than that. There are more stakeholders and many more transactions within this system. So we have funders, and we've talked about funders already quite a bit. But just to emphasize this, is that even if you just look at the U.S. alone, we've spent about $60 billion directly from the federal government on scientific research. Just NIH-funded science alone produces about 90,000 papers per year. That's a huge amount of science that is immediately inaccessible to the scientists that are part of that process, to the taxpayers that funded it, and to the institutions that funded it. So you're buying back your research in a lot of ways. So the creators, and I've already explained that in a traditional publication workflow, upon acceptance, that authors transfer most, if not all, of their copyright to a publisher. And it was, there was that comment before when we talked about sort of APCs and authors paying to publish. And I would argue that they're paying pretty heavily when they publish right now. We may not have a dollar sign on it, but they're trading something pretty significant. Producers, and you know, this might not be the best word here, maybe we would say organizers, but publishers here. And you know, I'll state that I actually believe that publishers have and will continue to add value to this system. Traditionally, publishers organize peer review and the editorial process. They package individual journal articles. They disseminate and they market that content. And sometimes they offer prestige. And that's significant, but there's a lot of money tied up in that transaction. action and that work. As Tim already mentioned, the annual revenues for STEM publishing near $10 million, with, depending upon the source you're looking at, up towards 40% profit margins. What I think also belongs to this group, which we haven't necessarily talked about yet today, but I think we will, is societies. Societies can be their own publishers. But increasingly, societies are looking towards large publishers, Elsevier, Springer, Taylor, and Francis, to do some of this work for them. And I think it's important to note that very broadly, if you look at the missions of societies, it's to facilitate communication within a discipline and across experts. And the mission of society is fundamentally different than the mission of a for-profit publisher. That said, societies are struggling financially, and many times it is their premier publications that are sustaining them as an organization. The buyers in this situation, and to go back to Tim again, this is primarily libraries. So libraries are the brokers of this content. But sitting on top of what they might license, and buyer is probably a poor word for this, it's licensor, is the added dimensions of use and restrictions that their agreements with publishers add into an already complicated system. And libraries do their due diligence to ensure that their agreements with publishers meet the guidelines of fair use. But oftentimes, what we sign on the dotted line restricts even more access to this content. And then we have readers, and we have scientists at readers who have, at the very beginning of this process, essentially given away their research products. They're having to buy back access to the content, and oftentimes that's happening, their libraries doing that on their behalf. There's readers that don't receive support from libraries, like we just discussed in the last presentation. Taxpayers, of course, but there's also machine readers, and I think that's increasingly important to recognize, is that part and parcel of this system is a wrapping around of the content that makes it not as accessible by machine readers as it could be. So the value of that content, text mining that content, and what that could reveal and tell us is diminished. So what I would say is that because the science, the actual discovery of science, has been locked away by its commodification of the commodification of its expression. So what's the impact of this? And we actually don't have that much data about the impact of not being able to access something. So there's this idea that's going around right now to have this open access button. So you'll be able to click a button when you hit a paywall. And the idea was like making noise before us so we can start to see what it means when someone can't access the literature. But there's a lot of information about what happens when people can access information. So there's many studies looking at higher citation counts, higher downloads, higher page views. And then we have information like this coming directly from scientists. If you've never looked at the that Twitter handle Overly Honest Method, I encourage you to do so. But I use this one all the time. I think it's pretty impactful. And then we have this. And if you're not familiar with this, we in the last talk, borrow, beg, and steal. Maybe this falls under steal. Maybe it falls under steal smartly. This is a Twitter hashtag that actually got a lot of press recently, where Reader's Wall type, will use this hashtag to tell people on Twitter they need access to this article and where they can be found, and then someone emails them access to the article. So, you know, the prevalence of this, I think, demonstrates that people aren't getting access to what they need, even through, you know, their connections to libraries. Because oftentimes, and there's been PLOS, a small study of the use of this hashtag, this is students. These are scientists affiliated with universities. So I would argue that there's got to be a better way. I'm using the idea of the commons here, not only to directly reference Creative Commons as a new sort of imagining of rights and expressing your rights and expressing how you will allow others to use your work, but also the idea of going back to the, you know, those people that I pointed out in the system, the buyers, the producers, the creators, the funders, everyone adds value, and that we're going to have to come together and collaborate to find these solutions, and there will be times when relationships will be antagonistic, but I think coming together as a commons towards finding better scientific communication will ultimately be more productive. What I haven't mentioned here, and I've actually gone through this much faster than I thought, but it was difficult to bring it, is the idea of intellectual property. And really, if you were going to fully investigate, specifically, if you were going to fully examine scientific communication and journal publishing, patents also need to be addressed. If you go to the University of Washington's tech transfer department, or Oregon Health and Sciences University's tech transfer department, any university, there's much verbiage given to and asking scientists not to communicate their work if there's any chance that it could result in an invention or a device that can be patented. But the other half of that is that, so that impacts when and what scientists communicate, but much of that results in that sort of stifling, you might say, of communication doesn't necessarily result in a large number of patents. So what actually gets patented, what actually gets licensed out from the university, and the rewards that an individual scientist may reap from that, there doesn't seem to be an equal balance between that and product and the sort of communication that isn't happening because of those instructions. And again, that's sort of an appendage to this talk, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention it as part of the overall complex of intellectual property and scientific communication in journals. So that's it.
Their articles on how respected by the size of the box.
Yes. Well, my experience has been that when they know they can do that, and when they are the corresponding author, that they'll think about it and they'll do it if it's important to them. You know, I mean, I for me, there are two issues that I encounter quite often in my work. Is that one, authors sign that document without even thinking about it. So, and you know, it, within you know, the scientific peer review papers, they're one of many, many authors. You know, and they kind of are making a decision that affects, you know, all of those creators in very profound ways. So, one, it's been an uphill battle to get people to think about what they're signing. And then two, I think a lot of misinformation about what will it mean to my paper being accepted if I push back on this. So we try to do a lot of education at OHSU to communicate that your paper will not be rejected because you asked for a rights addendum. I think the other, you know, piece of this is actually making authors aware of the rights they do have right out of the box. I mean, you know, Green Away, which I'm sure Michael will address, many of the large publishers allow some kind of not immediate embargoed Green OA that will make their works much more accessible than if they don't act, you know, if they exercising it, making those works much more accessible.